Today on Rock in the Suburbs.
I'd like to apologise to the world on behalf of the UK for that. It's Stephen Routledge here in Scotland, not calling in for my music picks. And with me today,
Mike Coley here in Central New York.
We teased it, but and it's finally here. It took Black Sabbath for an entire week, Mike.
Many months in the making. We started talking about this way before the finale concert.
Yeah, no, it's... Yeah, that added gave an additional sort of poignancy and a bit more framing to our thoughts and conclusions. Made it a bit more relevant, I guess. But we talked about it. We did Iron Maiden week. We did Metallica week. So you could say, Mike, that we're going back to the beginning.
Yes, we are.
Unlike Hands of Brittany, who are actually at that show, we're not there, but we are going to talk about all the music of Black Sabbath and related projects. Let's leave it at that, shall we? Because there's quite a bit to get to.
It's a sprawling tree, that's for sure. Anything associated with Black Sabbath.
Yeah, we've got notes, we've got spreadsheets, we've got family trees, and we're probably still going to miss stuff.
We've got books, we've got magazines. We are well versed here. So here we go.
Indeed. Let's do it, Mike. Yeah, so Black Sabbath, as I mentioned recently when I was talking about Bob Dylan, with Justin, in that, you know, we should be doing this. And, you know, for me, I think possibly because of my age and when I first started getting into music and particularly into metal, you know, Sabbath was the band I was aware of. But I didn't start with them, unlike the whole genre. And yeah, when we talk about the influence and importance of it, you know, I think I just need to say this right at the start, because we're going to get deep into the weeds probably at times, that without doubt, Black Sabbath obviously are the most important band in the history of heavy metal. Yeah, they invented it. And anyone who says that they're not the most important band in the history of heavy metal doesn't really know what they're talking about.
They are the beginning. There may have been some bands who've gotten into it a little bit before they came on the scene, and there may be, you know, the term itself, heavy metal, from a Steppenwolf song, supposedly. But Sabbath is the be all end all. I mean, they created the sound.
Yeah, I believe the term was also potentially used before, again, to describe when reviewing our Humble Pie album, Rockin' the Fillmore. I think it was first potentially used in there as well. I heard that recently. But, you know, it's indisputable that there isn't anything recognisable as heavy metal until Black Sabbath come along, is there? There's music that gets close, and we'll talk about that particularly when talking about their first album, I think, but... It's kind of like a judge was asked, UK judge was asked once, you know, how do you define pornography? Well, I think it was in the Lady Chatterley Loves trial, when it was the indecency trial about that. And he said, well, because, yeah, what's the line between art and pornography? He said, well, the thing is, you'll know it when you see it. And it's like with a metal, you'll know it when you hear it. Or as Joe Fleischer might say, if it's false metal and...
Death to false metal.
Indeed, and we'll probably get to some of that as well at some point this week. anyway, Mike, so what was your introduction to Black Sabbath, and what was your kind of history with the band before we dive into the catalogue and history?
I was telling a story to a friend of mine the other day, and how I came upon Black Sabbath's music. And when I think I was in seventh grade, I used to hang out with a bunch of guys in this housing development over near the Air Force Base, and they were playing the Ozzy album, Speak of the Devil, I think it was, the live one with Brad Gillis on guitar after Randy Rhoads died, where CBS, the record label, they wanted Ozzy to do an album full of Sabbath songs. And he was reluctant to do that because he was putting his new band together. He had his new band, but this was, I think, after, I forget exactly the timeline. I'll have to look at the timeline. But I heard Iron Man, and it was an Ozzy song to me because of that album. I didn't realize he was doing all Sabbath songs on this album. So I heard Iron Man, I heard Paranoid, and I had an argument in the cafeteria during lunch one day when somebody said that Black Sabbath performed Iron Man, and I said, no, that's an Ozzy Osbourne song, not knowing that Ozzy was in Black Sabbath. So that seventh grade was my first exposure to Ozzy / Black Sabbath, and then I kind of, you know, as I drifted through junior high and high school, I came upon more of the Dio era more so, because I became a big Dio fan, not knowing, again, that he was in Sabbath. Then I discovered that he was in Sabbath. This was maybe early high school years. And I started listening to Heaven and Hell, and then I got Mob Rules, and I got Live Evil, and that was my Sabbath until maybe my college years, when I started really digging into the Ozzy era of Sabbath. So that's my little walkthrough Sabbath discovery.
Yeah, no, I didn't. My first kind of awareness of Sabbath really was, I think, listened to a radio show at the time that was a lot of the rock and heavy metal show. It was on a Friday night on Radio 1 at the time, and unfortunately, and this probably coloured my opinion, it was for they had Tony Iommi and Tony Martin on for the Headless Cross, so that was the one that had just been released at that point, so that would have been about 87, he says, checking timeline, potentially, 89 is Headless Cross, which that's my first sort of contemporaneous Sabbath album, and I was like, yeah, okay, that's all right, I guess. But obviously I knew that they were supposed to be this pivotal band in sort of inventing metal, but I was like, well, I wasn't that blown away when I heard what was on Headless Cross, so it didn't really encourage me to dig any deeper, and it wasn't until I got into a lot more later that I sort of then went back, probably around the time of the reunion shows and album, that was probably when I really started digging more back into the catalogue and actually getting stuck in, probably later still than yourself. So I think partly for that reason, like I was saying, they're not my favourite metal band, but they're certainly the most important metal band, we've got a lot of good music to talk about.
Really, I mean, just when you delineate between the Ozzy years and the Dio years, two most popular eras of Sabbath, they're almost two completely different bands, and we'll talk about.
Yeah. We'll keep our powder dry on that, but yes, we can break that down a bit more. But yes. Okay, so let's rewind, as we said, back to the beginning, and so what became Black Sabbath started in 1968. Because Bill Ward and Tony Iommi were in a band called Mythology, which was had a sort of quite a big local following up in the north west of England, a place called Carlisle. That split up after a drugs bust. They ended up back in Birmingham. Ozzy had posted a note saying that he was a singer needing a gig, had his own PA, which was his main attraction, I think.
That's what brought him on board. You get your own equipment, you're in. Can you sing? Well, we'll think about that later.
That's secondary. You've got your equipment, yeah. And I think it was Geezer that first, who'd been in other bands previously playing guitar, had hooked up with Ozzy, who had been at school with Tony, although the year below, and foreshadowing somewhat. I think it's pretty well established that Tony probably wasn't the kindest to Ozzy when they were at school.
Yeah, Ozzy recalls several times how he was bullied by Tony back in the school years.
Yeah, I think when they first, when Geezer said, we're going to go around and meet up with Bill and Tony to try this, perform this band, Ozzy really had to be sort of dragged almost kicking and screaming because he didn't want to be in a band with Tony Iommi. However, they did start off as what was known as the Polka Talk Blues Band. And had they kept that name, we probably wouldn't be talking about them today, would we, Mike?
No. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Yeah. And originally they were a six-piece as well. They had a slide guitar and a sax player, and Geezer switched from guitar to bass because they didn't have a bass player, which is partly what influences his kind of style of playing, which is quite distinctive and unusual compared to what would be called a traditional bass player. So they start gigging a bit around the Midlands and Birmingham and that, and they then change their name to Earth, and they shed themselves down to a four-piece, and then Tony gets the opportunity to go and join Jethro Tull. So he heads off down to, he'd sort of, because he'd had more experience of playing with along with Bill in his previous band Mythology, he gets asked by Ian Anderson to go and join Jethro Tull. So he goes down to London. Geezer goes with him as moral support, and Tony is actually in Tull at the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus concert, which of course that footage didn't emerge for quite a long time after.
Yeah, I came across that on one of the streaming services in the last few years. I'd never watched it before and didn't even realize that Tony was part of Jethro Tull.
Yeah, not for long.
Yeah.
He didn't like, you know, basically being told what to play. He wanted to do his own thing. And, I think he found he wanted to be, and again, foreshadowing, wanted to be a bit more in control. But he did learn from Ian Anderson that, because they were a successful band at this point, that you've got to treat it like work. You've got to treat it like a business. You know, you've got to turn up and put in the shifts. So he went back to Birmingham and sort of starts cracking the whip and getting them to rehearse more, getting tighter, getting organised. And in 1969, they renamed themselves from Earth because they turned up to a gig and there was another band called Earth who the promoter thought they'd booked, and they started playing their stuff, which at this point did include the song Black Sabbath.
Wasn't what they were expecting.
They were expecting a nice little dance, sort of, Bill Haley style stuff, and they got What Is This Thing That Stands Before Me. Needless to say, the promoter gave them the money and said, please leave now. Don't come back. So they renamed themselves to Black Sabbath, and it's really from there that things start to take off. The sort of combination of the name change and them discovering this new sound that is most prevalent on the song Black Sabbath. And yes, it doesn't sound quite like anything else anyone's heard until this point, really, does it?
The opening sounds, you hear the storm rolling through, you hear the bells in the tri-chord, you're in a completely different world. Even 30 years later, even now, to be honest with you, it's a spooky, spooky song, just the way it's presented.
No, you're not wrong, Mike. Well, tell you what, let's have a quick listen to a bit of that. Give some music for those who maybe aren't metalheads, aren't familiar with this song, and then we'll talk a bit more about the song, the first album, and go from there. We'll be right back. how more metal could it be, Mike?
Stuff of nightmares right there.
But yeah, they said that when they started performing this song for the first time, it instantly got a reaction that their other stuff just didn't, people went crazy in both good and bad ways, but people started reacting to it and engaging with it, let's not forget, they're playing this song in 1969.
It's not Incense and Peppermints, that's for sure.
This is not Flowers in the Hair and, psychedelia stuff, this is pretty intense. And now, famously, they'd made the decision when they, I think it was possibly Bill that initially came up with the idea, and then sort of Geezer, who, for those that don't know, wrote nearly all the lyrics for the Black Sabbath songs, as well as obviously some of the riffs, but Tony doing most of the music, that they're rehearsing opposite a theatre where the film Black Sabbath was playing. And they said that, funny how people get paid to get scared at a film, why don't we do that with music? And that was kind of the genesis of the idea for the song Black Sabbath, which then became the name of the band and their debut album.
That's a brilliant idea, because it's amazing it hadn't been thought of before that, honestly.
Yes, parents had been scared by rock and roll, but the kids hadn't been scared by it. Not until they heard this.
Guess what?
And, this would it will cause them problems down the line in various ways, shapes, and form. But what you can't dispute is that they created something that no one else had done before. Although, interestingly, you mentioned the tritone, which is that intro riff that Tony plays, and the what is known as the Diabolus Musica, the Devil's Interval, that was sort of banned in music for quite a while in the Middle Ages because it was considered too evil. Another very famous left-hand guitar player makes use of two-thirds of that. The intro to Purple Haze uses the first two notes of that same interval. Just doesn't take it the third way, so it's... But anyway, that's a little by-the-by. They soon start to get a bit more of a buzz, get signed, and in the space of 2 days, record what becomes Black Sabbath, the album. And they're on their way.
Yeah, that's the album that definitely kickstarted. But, when you think about the stuff that came from that album, not a whole lot of it is still, out there in the metal pantheon, I guess you could say. But it still laid the groundwork. Once you get to Paranoid, that's when things really start going in.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. No, I 100% agree with you. I think it's the most important album in metal because it creates metal. But my feelings on the first album is that other than the title track and NIB, anything else on the album, it's showing their blues band roots. It's heavier than blue stuff, but the rest of that album, apart from those two songs, you could put on Led Zeppelin 1 or Jeff Beck Group album or Disraeli Gears, and it wouldn't be out of place.
Right, yeah.
It's just heavy blues, whereas those two are definitely something else.
They're definitely distinct from the other songs. And one of the things that they ended up having to do is just kind of split up songs, because they only had 5 songs recorded for the album and the record company wanted more. So they ended up splitting the songs up. So the third track is Wasp, Behind the Wall of Sleep, basically, and then NIB. The final track is A Bit of Finger, Sleeping Village, and Warning. Now, those don't really roll off the tongue as Sabbath classics. But as you said, NIB for sure. And they all kind of roll into one song, those two tracks on the first album.
And they do that on some of the other albums, and I believe, Mike, that the reason for that is, not you personally, but it was for the American market that you had to have 8 tracks for it to be classified as an album.
Yes, that's, yeah.
So it's, so we'll blame you guys for that one.
We're to blame for a lot of things, so we can shoulder that blame too.
Yeah, that's quite low down the list of things, isn't it? Anyway, we get the first album comes out and is immediately successful in the UK because they've built this word of mouth following, and they get signed. It's charting and selling, and they get signed and it gets released in the States, and so that gets released in February, Friday the 13th, a deliberate choice by the record company of February, and so that later that year we get the second album, Paranoid, which comes out a mere 5 months later
in September.
September, and we get, as you alluded to, Mike, the next level. You know, they've discovered their niche with those two songs on the debut, and they take that and run with it somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, you get into Paranoid, and it's almost a greatest hits album as their second album. You know, kind of like Who's Next, you know, every song on Who's Next is a classic. Every song, just about every song on Paranoid, you can consider a classic. They've been covered by bands over the last 55 years.
Yeah, for me, there's four albums you can consider to be their best.
I agree.
By definition, those four, even though I still think Master of Puppets is the best metal album ever made, by definition, those four albums are all in the running to be considered the best album, metal album made as well. And yeah, whereas the debut, you've still got the lingering roots of the blues scene they came out of, with Paranoid, it's metal all the way. You know, it's full on. This is us now. They found their sound, and boy, do they come up with some great songs. As you said, just like riffs after riffs, just classics that are just definitive metal songs without any shadow of a doubt. I mean, we'll not play Paranoid because everybody knows Paranoid. What else? And the other song off of there you fancy hearing, Mike, you mentioned Iron Man. Shall we maybe give a little blast of that?
You get a little bit of Bill Ward's jazz sound and some of that drumming there.
You've been reading my notes, Mike. Because that's one of the things I was going to... One of the things to make too short to highlight. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you've got the riff. I mean, another just... I mean, they don't call him the Riffmeister General for nothing, do they? I mean, just classic riff. But I'm glad you brought that up actually, Mike, because particularly on songs like a song like Rat Salad, you know, that's got a lot of the jazz flavors are even more prominent, but it doesn't lose any of the power.
Yeah, it's got that shuffle, that little jazz shuffle on the cymbals.
Yeah, there's a lot of swing to a lot of the Sabbath songs, which comes from Bill Ward and him being such a big jazz guy, and that sort of being a big influence on him. And, you know, I mean, obviously every metal band is influenced by Sabbath, but that swing and that groove that is on certainly the earlier albums is something that, yeah, for example, Pantera would take and run with. but yeah, I mean, the only thing you could really say about this album is that it's got a terrible cover.
Yeah.
And it's not the last one with a terrible cover.
They weren't happy with it either.
They weren't happy with it. And I mean, it wasn't actually, the album wasn't going to be called Paranoid, was it? It was going to be called War Pigs, hence how they got a guy with the sword on the cover.
Yep.
But the record company was a bit sensitive, again, a subject we shall return to, about with the, obviously, the Vietnam War kicking off at that, you know, being ongoing at that time, and it was considered it might be a bit too controversial. So, so they changed the name to Paranoid, which became a hit single in the UK. Amazingly, they're on Top of the Pops, which is ridiculous, but also fantastic that it happened.
Imagine tuning into that show the first time.
Yeah, and Paranoid was almost not on the album, wasn't it? It was only recorded at the very last minute, again, to boost the running time. And they basically just came, sort of Tony just said, oh, I've got this. And they came up with it in the studio in about 5-10 minutes and knocked it out. And Geezer has said that, yeah, he was against including it on the album. He thought, and once you've heard this, you can't unhear it if you've not heard it before. He thought it was far too similar to Communication Breakdown by Led Zeppelin. And if you play them back to back, you can definitely hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not so much in the intro riff, but in the rest of the song, although, you know, Jimmy Page is hardly one to complain about anyone nicking ideas from his music. So he's on very thin ice there. So, but yeah, and this album obviously was an even bigger hit on both sides of the Atlantic, wasn't it? And they were flying at this point, you know.
So can we talk a little bit about Tony's style?
Absolutely.
Now, when he had an industrial accident working in a sheet metal plant, I believe it was, sheet metal fabricating plant?
That's correct. On his last day in the job, unbelievably.
Yeah, and he ended up losing the tips of two of his fingers. So in order to continue, somebody that he worked with gave him a copy of Django Reinhardt's album, who Django also had difficulties with his hands and kept him from playing for a little while, and then he worked his way around it, and he became obsessed with Django Reinhardt, and all of a sudden he's like, I have to get back into it. So he fashioned these things to put on the tips of his fingers to play, but he also had to loosen the strings, which led to the Sabbath sound. Right? Was it?
Yeah.
Did he drop? Is that the drop D? Is that?
Drop D is just dropping the bottom string down a tone.
Okay.
So that's so that you can basically, instead of playing a power, you can basically play a power chord with one finger. So normally a power chord would be two fingers, one finger and two frets apart on the sixth and fifth strings. Whereas if you do a drop D, you can just put one finger across the same fret and you'll get the same effect because you've basically lowered it by a tone.
Okay.
He made these out of basically using an old fairy liquid bottle, bits of plastic, molded them with a soldering iron, and then put some bits of leather on as caps to kind of protect the ends of his fingers. I don't think he started dropping the tuning until Master Reality, because that's, you know, how that sounds significantly heavier.
Yeah,
that's when they started lowering the tuning. I think because they'd been playing live so much by that point, his fingers were really starting to protest. And so, a lot of his sound on the first two albums does come from the fact that he used very light strings. In fact, they didn't actually make strings a light enough gauge that he wanted to use. So he started off using banjo strings, which again makes the strings slacker, which does contribute to that to that sound, you know. And you're absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. He despaired of ever playing again until someone said, "Hey, listen to this guy. He's only got two fingers. What's your excuse?" It's all pretty much. But yeah, the tuning hole down that comes with, from my understanding, was that comes from Master of Reality, the album that follows this.
Okay, that makes sense.
Significantly heavier sound as a result. I would say to folks, yeah, if you're going to start with a Sabbath album, you can't really go wrong starting with Paranoid, because
the production is infinitely better than the first album. Obviously, they've done remasters and stuff throughout the years, but when you listen to the first two back to back, you can definitely tell that first one was recorded in 2 days.
Yes, I mean the second one was not recorded. I think it was still done in like a week, wasn't it?
2 weeks.
It wasn't that long in the gestation. I mean, given the fact it comes out 5 months after the first one. Yeah, I mean, everything has moved on. Production, the songwriting, the performances. Yeah, they can hear the Ozzy's vocals being double-tracked there as well. You know, that gives it that kind of that edge to Ozzy's vocals, you know.
One of the knocks on Ozzy's voice the first couple albums was that he was just kind of singing along with the notes of the song. And you can definitely pick up on that. But, I mean, a lot of people have done that over the years. And I guess, you know, they're still they found their footing with Paranoid, but then they expanded on it once they got into Master and Volume 4 and the remaining, you know, those first four or five albums were just, they finally dialed it in.
Yes, I think for the thing for, yeah, Ozzy, and maybe if you just touch on that a little bit now, in that, you know, obviously, yeah, he's not the world's greatest singer, you know, but what he was the perfect frontman for Black Sabbath.
Absolutely.
For two reasons, really, I would say. One, because he didn't initially have it, but he developed this very charismatic on-stage presence. But also, you know, going back to the song Black Sabbath, I mean, that anguished howl, you know, you could, yeah, Ozzy is clearly, he's not faking being in pain and being damaged.
Exactly, know? Yeah.
It's, yeah, you can feel the reality of it. It comes, it oozes out of his performances on these early albums, particularly. And it just suits the material perfectly, you know. It's not about how well he can sing it, it's about how he sings it.
Yes.
You know. And that's what makes it, yeah, just so right, because, I think when we did the, I sent in my little comment for the, after his passing, in that, you know, it's absolutely right. You'd look at Robert Plant and you might want to be Robert Plant. No one looked at Ozzy and thought, I want to be Ozzy.
You can't.
Because it was kind of like, yeah, it was this perfect storm. You know, if they'd had a different singer at that point in their career, maybe they don't create them, even though Ozzy didn't really write music, didn't really write lyrics, and didn't really, sometimes wrote some melody lines over the top of that, but he was just perfect for them and what they were creating at that time, you know.
And that's where the Ozzy-ness just takes, so that, yeah, that anybody else in that band, again, we wouldn't be speaking about them right now. At the beginning, anybody else trying to be, you know, being the singer of that band, it just wouldn't work. The four pieces came together. They grew up in the same, basically the same neighborhood. They grew up in the same circumstances, post-war England, mill towns, and that sound of the mills, just constantly the banging coming from the mills, kind of helped them form their identity as this band. And it just, all the stars aligned for them. And with Ozzy saying he was a singer, despite the fact that Tony was like, wait a minute, this guy doesn't sing. And but he's got a PA, so let's give him a shot. And it just worked. Otherwise, we're not talking about him.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, too right. Paranoid is their first classic album, and it achieves the success that, you know, it deserved and was expected, and is followed in 1971 by Master of Reality, which, as we mentioned briefly before, is a significantly heavier, just sonically, it's a denser, thicker sound, partly because of the dropping the tuning, and it's just, I think it's their most consistent album of the, certainly of the Aussie lineup.
And that didn't come, that was, I think, January of 71, maybe? July 71.
So, yeah, September 70 was Paranoid, and then basically just touring.
So they ripped this one out pretty quickly, too, following Paranoid and Black Sabbath in 1970. You know, you're still 7 months into 71. They got another whole album that's full of great music. Children of the Grave, all-time heavy metal classic.
It's the clear standout on the album. I mean, the whole album is great, but it's the clear standout, isn't it? And my notes on that were, a young Steve Harris must have heard that and thought, hang on a minute. If I just make that a little bit faster and have two guitars, I could build a whole career out of that.
Kind of did,
I did.
Steve Harris from Iron Maiden, for those not in the know.
But no, everyone's listened to Maiden Week, obviously, Mike, so they'd be fully
aware. Yes, because Maiden Week, yes, we did apprise them of the genius of Steve Harris.
But also Into the Void is another classic on there, and I think that's very much an influence on the 80s thrash scene and sort of the precursors of thrash, like bands like Diamond Head. Yeah, clearly took a lot from Into the Void, I would say. Again, even if perhaps the breakdown in that song recalls a whole lot of love a little, but it's just a just another absolute classic, and the second on the list of the four I would consider eligible to be their best. You know, if you said this is the best one instead of Paranoid, it's hard to argue, you know, or vice versa.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's just. Yeah, there's no. It hasn't got the hits on it. Yeah, in the same way of like, yeah, War Pigs, Iron Man, and Paranoid, but it's just an absolute banger.
It's got the embryo of what would become thrash later on.
The embryo, yes, I see what you did there, Mike. But I think songs like Embryo, Orchid, and Solitude, they could reinforce what they were doing with songs like Panic Caravan and Paranoid, in that you can have these quieter, sort of jazzier moments without it becoming, but still keeping it metal. You know, it's still intense and heavy and dark. But it's still giving that change of pace. So what was your reckon, Mike? Bit of Children of the Grave maybe slot in here? Because that's just, I mean, any excuse to hear that, isn't it, really? I think
Children of the Grave is just classic.
Yeah, let's hit it. We'll be right back.
those drums, tribalness of those drums, it's just mesmerizing.
But again, you can hear the jazziness in there as well, isn't there? In his technique, it's kind of, it's like this absolute metal classic, and yet there's still these other, there's still that kind of looseness and that kind of jazziness that Bill brings to the table, you know, that someone like, for example, a John Bonham, who, you know, given he was also from Birmingham, you know, they knew and were pals with, you know, he didn't have, you know, John Bonham drumming on this track would sound very different.
Hugely different.
Yeah. And people think, oh, sure, it'd be great. But it probably wouldn't, because it wouldn't fit the vibe and the feel. You know, it would be, another absolute classic album. And I just listen to it, folks. It's great. It's not much more you can say, is there, Mike, really?
No. Sorry, we're supposed to be breaking this down, but there's not a whole lot more you can say about it.
Basically, Paranoid, Master Eddie, you can't go wrong. Just listen to him, you won't be disappointed. Unless you really don't like anything heavy at all, in which case, you should still listen to him, because they're just great. But so, this also continues to sell well, and they're sort of becoming a bigger and bigger live act, and selling lots of records, and in theory making lots of money, but we'll return to that subject. And so that was 1971. 1972, we get the somewhat imaginatively titled Volume 4, and this is the longest gap they've had between albums so far. It comes out in September, so it's a year and a couple of months after Master Reality. And this was recorded in Los Angeles at the home of the Mr. DuPont of DuPont Chemicals fame. I think it's safe to say they were fully embracing rockstar lifestyle at this point, Mike.
Yeah, they were really getting at it, for sure. They talked about, you know, when they were doing Masters, that they were smoking a lot of dope.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept away from the heroin, they kept away from the cocaine. Now we're starting to get where they're maybe making a little bit of money, and they're finding other ways to spend some of their money.
I mean this is not rumor, or this is just fact, because both Geezer, Tony, and other people have stated it as so. They even thank the quotes Coca-Cola Company of America in the album notes for Volume 4. They were getting boxes the size of speaker cabinets full of cocaine delivered to the studio. I think Bill nearly got fired at one. Bill said he was surprised he didn't get fired, because he was so off his face for a lot of time. He was just sitting in the middle of the floor in the studio, just like away on the clouds.
He definitely got himself in trouble a few times.
Although the band didn't help on that front.
Well, there was a lot of bullying that went on.
There was a lot of that, particularly mainly from Tony, let's be fair. This is not the first time that Tony nearly kills Bill. I mean, when we say nearly kills him, we do mean literally nearly kills him. What we're talking about is, so they were staying, renting the house rehearsal in LA that was owned by the guy who owned DuPont. And they found some gold paint, and one of the many things they used to do, one of them was setting Bill on fire briefly and then putting it out again. We shall return to that subject later. But they found some gold paint, so they decided to aerosol paint Bill with gold paint, which anyone who's seen the film Goldfinger will know. the colour doesn't matter, but the fact that it's paint does. If your skin can't breathe, things don't go well, and they didn't go well. And Bill starts having a seizure because obviously he's off his face on cocaine, and now his skin can't breathe at all. And so, ambulances are called, and fortunately they get there in time and they're able to straighten him out. But for what would not be the first time, Bill nearly dies in the recording of a Sabbath album.
Poor Bill.
Indeed. Anyway, forget about the drugs. Let's forget about the hijinks. Let's talk about the music of Volume 4, which was not going to be called, was going to be called Snowblind. But again, the record company got nervous because the title being far too explicit about their cocaine indulgence. And so Volume 4, taking a lead from Led Zeppelin, in some ways was decided upon. But yeah, what do you think of this album then, Mike?
This is, I go to this one quite often. Supernaut, I just love the riff in Supernaut. And there's been some really cool covers of that over the years. And it's just one of my favorite Sabbath songs that I go to all the time. Changes, when you look at Changes, that's, you know, they kind of did that ballad thing going. And I think that kind of laid the groundwork for the bands of the 80s where they would release a rocker and then a ballad as the standard way of releasing singles from albums. That one was kind of really out of left field for the band because it's basically just a ballad. And
yeah,
it's something you didn't really expect from them at that point.
Yeah, you could say that, Mike. You could say that. Yeah, I think I've been quite kind. yeah, so let's start with the positive. Yeah, Supernaut, as you said, absolute standout. Just another killer riff from Tony. Great drumming again from Bill. Frank Zappa was a particular fan of this song. Eulogised about it at length, and particularly Bill's drawing. But yeah, I think, and I'd also say that I suspect Lenny Kravitz has heard Supernaut at some point.
Yeah, he does have that.
Are you going to go my way? I think it's, let's say he was inspired.
A little bit of an influence there.
and a song like Under the Sun, you can particularly hear something like Fade to Black from Metallica in there.
Yep.
You pulled a lot from that. Yeah, for me, this is a really good album, but Changes is just like, what are we doing? What, yeah, it's a great ballad if it's on Wings Over America.
Right. And, you know, I'm not saying that's one song I will hit skip on. To be honest with you, it's a cool change of direction for them, and it kind of influenced things later on. But like when you hear Charles Bradley's version of it, of Changes, it's that he makes it his. So take it off of Volume 4. Let Charles Bradley have that one.
Yeah, I know particularly Ozzy was a massive, Ozzy and Bill were both huge Beatles fans, and yeah, that's obviously part of the influence coming out there. But yeah. This is Black Sabbath. This is heavy metal. We're not. It's not. We don't need it. Yeah, personally, and it does support me. Along with FX, which is basically the sound of a naked Tony in the studio with nothing but a crucifix on, and that sound of that crucifix bouncing off his guitar with a lot of reverb and delay, and that's the sort of thing that sounds great when you're completely off your face on coke. But when you listen back to it in the cold light of day, you're like, yeah, okay, I've heard this once, and I now don't need to hear it again.
Yeah, they probably could have used a no man in the studio at that point.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, don't do coke, kids. You make bad decisions. So yeah, Volume 4, it's still considered one of the classic sort of run of the early albums because obviously everything else apart from Changes and FX is fantastic. It's just, yeah, they just take the edge off of it for me. And yeah, you mentioned Changes. Sadly, skipping forward in time, you'll remember when Ozzy had his quad bike accident and was very seriously injured.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter Kelly had recorded a version of Changes with Ozzy, and that was released pretty much in the aftermath of this accident. So I have to hang my head in shame and say that went to number one in the United Kingdom. The Kelly Osbourne version of Changes.
It's a heartfelt father-daughter.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Sorry, I'd like to apologise to the world on behalf of the UK for that. Anyway. Let's move on to better things, Mike. So, lots of drugs going on, still lots of great music coming out. They try to record the next album in LA again, in the same rehearsal house, and it's not happening. There's no inspiration's drying up. There's nothing going on. So they end up coming back to the UK, and they set themselves up in a place called Clearwell Castle in Gloucestershire, which has, and they set up their rehearsal space in the dungeons of this castle, which is apparently haunted. And again, remember, large amounts of drugs being consumed most of the time. All the guys, at least, well, certainly Geezer and Tony Elsie have said that they see some, they see this ghost at some point, and they're trying to break the writer's block. And so the relocation to this sort of spooky location seems to do the trick, because they're not getting anywhere. Then Tony suddenly comes, goes deep into his bag, and pulls out, well, what can only be described, Mike, as possibly the greatest riff of all time.
Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath.
It just suddenly the dam breaks and the creativity starts flowing.
Yeah, there's a point where Tony says that's the riff that saved them.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Tony was talking at the point of, like, do we give up now? Because he was coming up with the majority, you know, Geese was coming up with some riffs, but Tony was coming up with the majority of the riffs. And, you know, if Tony can't come up with the riffs, what's going to happen? So, and we've got to hear it, Mike. Let's just play it. It's just too good, mate, not to hear it. Man, what a riff.
That is a killer riff. Ozzy just sounds like he's just kind of rejuvenated himself a little bit with the lyrics here, sounding somewhat possessed, just throwing like what he throws in that, you bastards.
Yeah. Ozzy sounds, I think this is his, he sounds great on this album. Well, the whole band does. And for me, this is their best album. It's certainly the best Ozzy era album. For me, yeah, just a classic, absolute, just phenomenal stuff, you know. I think what it does so well is that it takes a lot of the sort of the more progressive, like putting a little bit of keyboards and stuff into it, that started with Volume 4, it takes that, but just gets the balance just right.
Yeah, they brought Rick Wakeman in to play keys.
Yeah, and there was talk of him potentially joining Sabbath at one point. Because Yes had opened for Sabbath, and I think Rick didn't get on so well with the guys in Yes and liked hanging out with the Sabbath guys, but that didn't come to pass. But yeah, he played, but even on Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath itself, Mike, it's got that kind of, like, it's almost like a, you know, that really light breakdown. Yeah, the sort of second section where it all goes, the complete mood of the song changes before it goes back into the riff.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you've got a riff that can basically move entire mountain ranges on its own, you know, you can get away with having a jazzy interlude, you know, because you've just got this like monster riff there just pile driving through, you know. It's just
then it just stops on a dime and does that acoustics.
Yeah. But it, yeah, you've also got other just absolute classics on there, like Sabracadabra, you know, and also Spiral Architecture. They're all just great metal songs, aren't they? Just, yeah, straight onto the best of, you know.
Killing Yourself to Live.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just...
Just the riff, the riffage in that one is classic Tony as well.
Yeah, you know, we get a lot of synth work on, say, as you've talked about, on the song Who Are You, which is not a cover of the Who song. But I think it's the key is the synth work, because it stylistically fits. It's not kind of, oh, we're trying to go pop. It's just like, here's some dark, intense music that happens to have some keyboard synth parts in it, isn't it? Rather than, oh, we're adding synths to get modern, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then you get, like, that definitely had an influence later on with the symphonic type metal stuff that came about when, oh yeah, you can, because, you know, Iron Maiden was famous for putting in their liner notes, no synths, but when done right, you can definitely have synths in a metal song and make it sound like it belongs. And, yes. And they accomplished that here, and bands down the road that incorporated synths, they were able to figure it out and make it work. And it does work in the metal realm.
Oh, well, my notes on this video, the sixth was Owner of a Lonely Heart. This is not.
No. It is not.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, we've covered quite a lot of ground there, Mike.
Yeah, we went pretty quickly through a few years there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's actually, yeah, we're only up to 1973, but we've covered 5 albums. And sort of three and a quarters of which are classics. you know, 3 3/4, which are just fantastic. Yeah, I think what we'll do, yeah, so we'll maybe take a pause there, and then we shall return tomorrow to continue on the story of Black Sabbath. And I think what we shall do to play out, because I realised that we didn't play anything off of Volume 4, so let's go out with a bit of Supernaut, because that's a pretty good way to wrap things up for day one, I think, Mike, eh?
Yes, absolutely.
Good stuff. Well, I hope folks have enjoyed us talking about first day of Sabbath week and talking about Sabbath. Be sure to send your comments in to rocketsuburbspod.com or call the Suburban Party line. You can get the podcast on all the socials. It's at suburbspod. You can find me on Facebook. I'm just at Stephen Routledge on Facebook. And Mike, people can find you.
Oh, I'm on Facebook at Mike Coley, and I'm on Blue Sky. I think I'm at Mike Coley on there as well. Instagram, same thing. I'm at Mike Coley. Pretty much everywhere. I think Instagram is SwampRat16. But I also have a radio show on Saturdays on Suburbs Radio called Walking at a Suburban Pace. I'm all over the place. I played, you know, yesterday's show was my daughter's birthday. We did songs that she chose. So she actually picked Iron Man as one of her songs.
Yes, I saw there's some good choices on there. Some good parroting wins there, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. So tune in on Saturdays for Walking at a Suburban Pace on Rockin' the Suburbs Radio at suburbsradio.com.
Great stuff. Right. Supernaut. Take it away.